From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's this idea in traditional economics that says humans, you know, consumers, make the decisions in their lives based on reason. We're rational creatures. But the fact is, it's more complicated than that. Let's take Utah's really terrible air right now. Just what is it that's keeping us from doing more to reduce emissions and energy use? One study asked people what would have a greater impact on their behavior. First, knowing what they did was good for the environment, or second, knowing what their neighbor was doing. Well, they'll tell you it doesn't matter what their neighbor is doing, but in fact, in practice, that's what mattered most. See, it's complicated. Today in the program, with the backdrop of all this crappy air, we're discussing our role in the problem, why we do the things we do, and what it takes to get us to change. After the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Looking at the toxic air trapped in the Salt Lake Valley lately is perfectly awful timing to have a conversation about pollution, and that's what we're talking about today, about this bad air. But let me focus the conversation, because what we're not going to talk about today is the role of industry in the pollution problem, though industry, of course, plays a role, and we've covered that on other shows. And we're not talking about what your neighbor is doing to make the air bad. The doofus in the parking lot with his engine running, the insensitive lady at the end of the block who keeps her lights on at all hours of the day. We're not talking about that either, because today we're talking about you and about me, about us. That is, what it is that we are doing to contribute to this bad air. Because observers say we have a tendency to want to blame others for the problem. But research shows the biggest problem is us. It's our homes and our businesses And yes, our cars, but even as we grow as a state, cars are going to be less of a problem in the coming years, and we are going to shoulder more of the blame. Experts tell us efforts to try and make that case does not seem to be working all that well, because it's hard to change, especially when there's a cost associated, and fixing this is going to cost something. It's going to cost money and convenience. The conversation today is about human behavior and psychology, really, why it is we act against our interests sometimes, and what it is that's going to get us to really make some meaningful change. So we invite you to join the conversation today. You can call 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. You can make comments on Facebook and on Twitter, but I want to say this again. Do not send comments that blame other people for the problem today. I'm not going to read them. We're not really interested in assigning blame. What we want, if you're willing to share or confess, is what it is specifically that keeps you, you personally, from driving less or making your home more efficient or buying a newer, cleaner vehicle. That is, what is it that would make you, help you make a change that would have an actual effect on this dangerous air? 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Okay, I've said a lot. Judy Faes is with us, a reporter here at KUER News. She's been covering environment and public lands, covering this issue for years now. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
So can we just talk broadly about the focus of the conversation today? Because this is something that you have thought a lot of, and that is the inclination that we tend to have sometimes, I think all of us, to blame the other smokestack rather than the smokestack at home or coming out of our own car. How are you thinking about this these days?
Well, I think it's such a tricky area because on the one hand, there are so many things that we have within our control to make change. And then on the other hand, we hear a lot of messages and we see the pollution outside and we feel so powerless. It's like, I can't do anything about this. Yeah. I can't stop the pollution. And then to some extent, you think, well, I can go up to the Capitol and complain about it bitterly, and I'm still powerless because it doesn't seem to change nearly enough for my taste. But there are things that we can do, and it's a challenge to think about, well, okay, can I manage my thermostat better? Can I is it time for me to buy a new car so that I can get one of those high smog rating cars that will help reduce our pollution dramatically? So it is easier to look at someone else and to say, well, they're the problem. But I guess I personally feel like there are a lot of things that I can do and I try to do. And I'm not perfect. I don't know that anyone really is. But you know, that's a discussion that we really don't seem to want to have. I don't really understand why that is, but especially considering people want things in their control that they can change. But in this particular case, it seems like we look to someone else to fix it for us.
But you don't think you understand why it is?
Not exactly.
I mean, that's essentially what we're going to try to figure out today. But
yeah.
you don't think you understand it at this point?
No, I do think that that when we reach out and we try to address the problem, if we look at other people, it seems like they have some control that we don't have. That at least that's what we think. And again, there are so many little things, but to gather them all and to actually implement them is really, I guess, the day-to-day challenge.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation, 801-585-9378. Let's take a few phone calls. I want to sort of jump into this. Jeff is with us in Holiday, Utah. Jeff, welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Go for it.
Nope.
Sorry.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say that I have a long commute. I work out at Kennecott and live on the other side of the valley. I have, because of that long commute and because of my concern with air quality, my wife and I have an electric car, and I try to drive it when I can, but it's not always convenient because the range barely gets me to work and back in the winter, and it's a little inconvenient to try and run errands. The electric car is great. I love it, but it doesn't work all the time.
I was going to ask you, Jeff, what made you decide to make that investment? Because certainly it hit your pocketbook a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was mostly associated with air quality concerns. My daughter has asthma, and I've lived in Salt Lake for long enough to know that the winters can be pretty miserable.
So Judy, it's personal. Maybe that's a thing, right? That the tipping point for a lot of people maybe is personal? Less for Jeff, it seems.
Yeah, I think that that's a big factor. I think it's fascinating to me, though, in the past when I've done stories on air quality, you can call pretty much anyone. You can just stick your finger down on the phone book and call somebody. And it's rare that there's someone that you reach someone who doesn't have someone close to them or who is not personally affected by air pollution. I don't think the argument anymore is this a problem? I think there's agreement, widespread agreement, that it's a problem that we need to deal with.
I have a question actually for our guests who are coming up just shortly on the program to get to this question of whether the personal, in fact, does work. So we'll find out what they have to say about that. Jeff, thanks for the call. Glad you joined us. Let's go back to the phones. Let's see. Allison is with us in Holiday. Allison, you with us?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate the thoughts of the previous speaker that everyone wants to be in control. Everyone is fairly self-centered in regard to what they want to do and their behaviors and actions. But, I mean, I think it's important that if everybody does their part, everybody tries to buy efficient vehicles that are probably smaller in size. If everybody doesn't idle to warm up their car on a regular basis. So I also believe that there have to be some changes taking place within the legislation mandating that, you know, all companies, like Tesoro is voluntarily going ahead and doing what they're doing to clean up the air as best they can help. You know, that sort of stuff needs to be mandated by our legislature. It needs to be a aggressive, intense action to take care of the problem.
Allison, glad you called. I want to actually talk about, to her point, the idea, the role that public policy can play in all of this. I don't want to spend the entire hour on it, actually, but I think this is a point that is made by one of our callers, Matt Pacenza, who is the executive director of HEAL, calling in. I'm guessing the public policy point is something you want to make, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely, Doug. I think that, you know, everyone has to agree that the decisions that we make as individuals are critically important. And it's, you know, it's what you drive, it's whether you drive, it's where you live, it's the size of your home. It's all kinds of decisions like that. But I think you almost can't exaggerate the powerful influence that public policy has upon each of those decisions. And one of the parallel examples that's interesting to look at is cigarette smoking. If you look, there was a chapter in one of Malcolm Gladwell's books about this. But if you look at the factors that have led many, many people to quit smoking, you find that a lot of it had to do with cost and convenience. And both of those issues were profoundly influenced by public policy. So government ended up deciding, let's make cigarettes a lot more expensive. And government ended up deciding, let's make cigarette smoking sort of more unacceptable. We're going to make it so you got to walk like 50 yards from your office building and huddle under a tree with like a nasty bucket next to you.
Right. And
those things ended up having powerful effects upon what were ultimately a series of individual decisions that literally millions of Americans made to be healthier. And I do think there's a lot of parallel there that you can bring to the air quality debate, that we can all say, you know, you should really get out of your car, or you should buy a more efficient vehicle. But the reality is that you need to make it easier for people to get out of their car by having a transit system which is more affordable and which goes to more places at more convenient times of the day. And the truth is that the way we're going to get to more efficient vehicles has to do primarily with government mandates, that individual cars be cleaner, that there are more electric vehicles, that there are tax incentives in place to make them more affordable. So I think it's, you just can't tease out those two things. They're sharply related, and I think you can simultaneously recognize that individual decisions matter, but also recognize that it is totally appropriate to, frankly, to point our fingers at institutions that can and must act to help people make better decisions.
Right, right. And I hope I'm not implying that pointing fingers is a problem. I want it to be a problem today because I want to focus the conversation. But Matt, point well taken. Judy, you want to respond?
Yeah, Matt, I agree. It's a really important point. And if you look at, for instance, a Tier 3 clean car, clean fuel law, that's going to make a huge difference, and none of us is going to have to change anything we do, except will the car we buy, because of the government mandate, will be cleaner in the future. So that is really fantastic. There are some areas, though, where this is really a challenge, and I think I want to go to one of what I remember as one of your sensitive spots, Matt, and that is wood-fired pizza. You know, that causes a lot of pollution, and I've heard Brian Mensch from Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment talk about, you know, the perils of grilling. And, you know, it may taste really good, but it's not so good for you and it's not so good for the air. So, you know, it's a really interesting question. What do we do beyond government mandates? And then when do we take those values and we go to our state lawmaker and say, hey, look, we want this change? I think you really have to have a personal feeling about it before you're really willing to go to the legislature and say, look, do it. Make this change now.
Matt, thanks very much, by the way. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Will you help me break down the numbers here? Because I think this is really important. Right now, and everyone sort of looks at this equation, the role of these various entities in the air pollution problem. There, you've got industry, you've got homes and businesses, you've got vehicles, basically. Now, the way it plays out right now, 55% of the emissions you can attribute to vehicles, basically, right?
Something
like that, a little bit more than half. But that's going to change in the near future. And as I was mentioning in the introduction, homes, businesses, personal decisions made by people are going to share more of the blame. Will you just sort of break that down for us and help us understand that?
Yeah, well, we mentioned the Clean Car, Clean Fuel law, which is called Tier 3. It's a federal law, and that's beginning to be phased in, and it should help transition our fleet, all of the vehicles, by 2025. That in, I'll use Bob Groh from Envision Utah's analogy, it's like taking 4 out of every 5 cars off the road. So even if we have population growth, there's going to be fewer of those dirtier cars and less of the dirty gasoline that we use now over time. And that we don't do anything and that's going to happen. So as the proportion of vehicle pollution goes down, the proportion of area sources pollution goes up. And that's basically, again, I'll borrow Bob Groh's analogy. He says that industry has a smokestack that you can see, those big smokestacks that release emissions. Our car tailpipes are equivalent to the smokestack from our vehicles. And then in our homes and businesses, we have vents that release emissions from our gas water heaters, our gas home heating, and other kinds of pollution emissions from consumer products like hairspray, solvents that we may use to clean up spots on our clothing, and then paint that has high volatile organic compounds, which help make up PM2.5 pollution, which is our winter smog. So we have those, and they're going to become a bigger part of the pie as the pie shrinks over time. And so the more emissions we can reduce from those sources, the better off we're going to be. I want to borrow one other example here from Utah Clean Energy. In their fact sheet, they have a point here. It says, if every home in Utah shaved their energy use by just 10%, we could save 9 million kilowatt hours of electricity and over 7,000 million cubic feet, so that would be a billion cubic feet, of natural gas annually, while preventing all the pollution that comes along with that energy. Just imagine that.
10%.
And that's by doing things like, you know, using a programmable thermostat, that kind of thing. Again, that's something that no one in government has to tell you to do, but you can do, and you can make a difference.
So this idea, would you talk about this idea of a golden thread, what it is? This is something you've been talking to us about, and what it is, if there is such a thing. Give us a sense of what a golden thread is, because I'm really intrigued by this.
Okay. Well, if you think of the sort of the fabric of the smog that we have, it's made up of all these different threads, like car auto body paints or consumer and commercial solvents, barbecue pits and pizza ovens and your backyard grill, heating, sewage, and then heating our homes. All those things are part of this fabric of pollution. And one of the problems that we have in Utah with our PM2.5 pollution is that it's a little bit different than all the PM2.5 everywhere else. If you live in New York, there's definitely more pollution in New York City. But since we have this geography that contains the pollution, it doesn't escape. So we have these big pollution spikes that New York doesn't have, even though they have more pollution. So at any rate, finding the thread, finding the one element of this pollution problem that's controllable and that we can implement some kind of mandate or technology to clean it up. The state doesn't really know what knobs to turn.
So what thing it is, if you pull it out, it'll collapse.
It'll collapse.
Is the thing. This is the worst thing. We don't really know.
Right. And it could be they're finding ammonia is part of that equation. And so
where does that come from, though?
Well, mostly from waste, human waste, animal waste.
Wow. Okay.
That's a big source of ammonia. Mm-hmm. And then NOx, nitrogen oxides, comes from heating. Those are some of the emissions from gas burning. And so, again, if they knew exactly what knob to turn, I think they thought for a while that it was actual PM2.5, which is soot, which is the product of combustion. But what they're learning is that all these other chemicals in our atmosphere are combining, and the actual PM2.5, the original PM2.5, can sometimes be only one quarter of the problem. So 75% can be secondary PM2.5 that's basically manufactured. So we need to find the thread that we can pull so that chain reaction of creating PM2.5 can happen. And you block the process.
Are they working on that? They're trying to find
it? Absolutely, yeah. I think the governor's budget this year has, I want to say, $250,000 exclusively for research, but there's all kinds of research projects going on at the university and other universities in the state to work on that problem.
Okay. Judy Fays, reporter for KUW. Can you stick around?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Stick around because we're going to actually get to the kind of behavioral part, the psychology part of these decisions that we make. But some questions may come up for you, Judy, that I want to have you help keep us honest about all of that. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what a lot of us have been talking about for the past few days, and that is this horrible air pollution trapped, of course, in the Salt Lake Valley these days, other valleys around the state. We're focusing, though, today on what it is that we can actually do about it, because observers say, well, there's a tendency we have to blame others for the problem, like industry, which, of course, is not to say industry doesn't play a role, but research shows the biggest problem really is us, our homes and our home activities. So part of this discussion is about behavioral economics, that is, why it is we act the way we do and what it is that it will take to really get us to make some change. Joining us now on the program is Mariel Beasley and Jamie Full. They're researchers at Duke University's Center for Advanced Hindsight. It's a research group that studies the irrationality of human behavior and how people make decisions. And they're joining us today from the studios of WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Mariel Beasley, Jamie Full, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having us.
So there's this sort of traditional economic theory that tries to explain why we humans make the decisions we make. And it's sort of based on this idea, and I know it doesn't work out so well, but it's based on the idea that we make rational choices, that we're pretty rational people. Explain why that actually isn't the case, that we're maybe not so rational when we make our decisions.
Because we're human, I think, is part of it. But so basically this idea was that people could kind of take all this information and synthesize it and think about probabilities and do all these calculations in their head and weigh costs and benefits to make a decision. And really it turns out that the human brain is not really formatted that way. We generally it would be physically impossible to actually do that for every single decision that we make throughout the day. You can think about whether you choose to drink water out of a bottle or out of the tap. You can think about which shoes do you wear when you get up in the morning. I mean, we make millions of decisions every day, and if we had to actually sit down and do the heavy lifting of weighing all the costs and benefits to make a rational decision, it'd be impossible. So in order to survive in this world, the brain uses these sort of mental shortcuts. And it has to do with how we filter information. It has to do with how we sort of take that information and act on it. And it's really a lot about helping us survive in a world. And just sometimes it backfires.
Yeah. And the good news, though, is the mistakes that we make or, you know, the irrational things we do, we're very consistent with it, which is why we're able to have a field called behavioral economics, because it's very predictable how people will behave in these non-optimal ways.
Here in Utah, there's some sense that that people who have good intentions are more interested in blaming industry or government than each other. And I'm wondering, is that part of it? Because it seems to be this factor here of sort of overestimating our own efforts, that we're doing enough and underestimating the efforts of others. I think you call this licensing. I'm not sure if shifting blame is the right way of putting it, but would you lay this out for us?
Sure. Well, there's two things. The first is the assignment of effort. And one interesting thing we find is that when you ask couples about housework and their contribution to it, they usually both say about 75%.
Right.
Unless they have a house somewhere else, you know, that's clearly not adding up. So we definitely see that people overestimate their contributions in that specific situation. And it happens as well, you know, when it comes to energy consumption. Licensing is what happens when you do something good, and then that gives you a license to do something not so good. Mm-hmm. And people sort of think those will cancel each other out. So I'll go for a run this morning, and then I'll have a donut. You know, the run unless it was really long, did not cancel out the donut. And we see that happening, you know, with environmental stuff as well, where people will be good in one environmental way, and so then they won't be in another. And so sometimes the good intentions backfire because the net effect is you know,
right,
not good.
Right. And we're pretty bad at estimating as to which of these actions that we're choosing between. It's really difficult to know which one's the better, sort of the greater good. So, you know, if I recycle at home, is it bad that I drive to work? If right. I have energy efficient light bulbs, is it okay that I don't have an energy efficient washer? And it's, you know, we don't have a good way to compare on those things. But because we – so there's this theory in psychology called cognitive dissonance theory where basically we have a – you know, we all pretty much think we're good people, right? We try our best, we do our hardest, and if something if we do something bad, we generally think it's not our fault. It's environmental. It's but we want to kind of maintain this sense of that we're good people. And so when we're presented with information that suggests that maybe we're not or we're failing in certain things, it creates this pretty intense conflict internally. And so one of the things that – one of the reactions that you do to it is you can actually just kind of ignore the right. information that's given to you to tell you that, like, well, you're actually not doing this well. This is contrary to your beliefs. We tend to discount that information.
And go into denial? Is that
yeah,
part of
so it?
It can definitely
be denial. This one of the early sort of studies about this was around a cult that thought the world was going to end on a very specific day. And so a young researcher, Leon Festinger, went to the cult to basically see what happens the day after. Like what happens when their whole world view that they've constructed about themselves is shown that it doesn't – that it's not true.
Yeah, wow.
And instead of actually – so and then instead of saying like, oh, gosh, wow, we were wrong –
Yeah, the world didn't end.
Right, exactly. Spoiler alert, the world did not end. So the next day, when people kind of woke up, it wasn't that, oh, gosh, we were wrong. We need to, like, look back on our beliefs. They basically constructed a whole other theory where they were still right, and actually they were so devout and faithful that God or the gods had changed their mind and decided to save the world because they were so devout and faithful in what they believed.
So we're so
malleable.
So you
kind of find these other ways to justify yourself.
Yeah, we're pretty malleable in the way we can sort of work through these things.
We're amazing storytellers.
Yes.
Yeah.
We as in human beings.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so interested in the particular, there's this a paper that you referred us to, which sort of broke down some of the kind of the biases that are involved here when we make decisions. There's the loss and risk aversion bias. There's status quo bias. And we can talk about the particulars of some of these. Maybe say something about the status quo bias, this idea that we're inclined to want things to what? Stay the way they are?
Basically, I mean, when something's already set up a certain way, it's just much easier to go with it, particularly if it's something that you don't really care about. And there's also, if something is a default or what currently is what we'll be using, there's also this implicit suggestion that it's the right thing. So if you have to go in and, you know, change your bulbs, but none of your lights came with the good ones, again, implicit suggestion that doesn't really matter as much. But it kind of comes down to a little bit of laziness.
Yeah.
And even if, right, and so you have sort of this idea, this implicit suggestion that it's the right thing. So even if you know it's the wrong thing for the environment, you think it's the right thing for other reasons, right? So maybe it's the wrong thing for the environment, but maybe it's the right thing because, oh, you know, I heard that those new light bulbs have mercury in them, and so maybe I don't want to throw them out, and so it might actually have detrimental effects later on. Right. So we kind of create these ideas to justify why this is the right thing, even if all the information presented to us tells us it's actually not the right thing for the environment.
You know, you often hear that argument related to public transit in Utah and a lot of criticism about the public transit system these days. And one of them is time and money, that I would take public transit, but it's so damn expensive or it's so incredibly inconvenient. It would take me an hour to get to work when it would take me 10 to drive. Is that what's going on there, that same kind of thing?
Definitely. So there's also this incredible present bias, right? So we overvalue like immediate rewards, things that are in the future. And so we know about the long-term benefits of sort of moving away from single occupancy vehicles And we know about that it'll have long-term effects on air pollution. But what we're really concerned about is, like, what are our needs right now?
Right.
What are sort of what's immediate? What can happen right now? And those, even if, you know, we were able to project out and discount and all those things, we know that, like, global warming and air pollution and asthma are a lot more important than our own convenience. But because of the time aspect of those, that's really what drives people to prioritize this convenience factor. I mean, you can imagine if you ask somebody, okay, you make a pick right now, you either get asthma immediately or you have to spend an hour on a bus. You know, if you bring both of those choices into the immediate future, well, then we can actually – then most people would say, okay, yeah, I'll take the bus for an hour instead of taking asthma right now.
Yeah, they're just not thinking that when they get up in the morning, asthma or, you know, car. And another thing we find is that because the decision moment is also often a moment where you're vulnerable and thinking about the present, one thing we think a lot about doing is getting people to pre-commit to doing these good things when they're in that moment of feeling good about themselves. And so we found that if people announce their intentions to, you know, take a bicycle to work the next morning and they've told other people, you know, in some instances, they're more likely to do that. So there are some ways we have around making these bad decisions in the moment by making the decision before that moment comes.
Yeah, a good example.
Go ahead.
Sorry, a good example was when I was starting grad school, I really wanted to kind of commit to exercise. I really wanted to commit to, you know, being more active, spend more time outside. And so I sold my car. And so I made that decision not in a moment where I'm deciding, do I drive to work or walk to work right now? I made that decision at a time where I was feeling very idealistic.
Yeah.
And then I took the choice out, right? Then I had to bike. I had to bike to work. And, you know, that's just kind of an extreme example of how you can do things to set up your environment to really force you into a decision so that you're taking out the tension of that exact moment.
Yeah. It's that old story of you throw your hat over the wall and you commit, so you have to go after it. You pre-commit.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Judy, you had a question.
Yeah, I was wondering if you have explored the question of why we're willing to give up so much of our power, why we would prefer to have someone else be responsible for why we can't do something rather than to say, oh, I have a way I can fix this. What's going on there?
So this might be kind of getting at it. So there's something called the choice paradox. We like the idea that we have lots of options and that we're in control of what we can do. But it's actually really overwhelming when you have all those options. And there's some studies that show that the more options that you have, the less likely you are to choose any of those options because it's just too much information to process. And so I think the idea of having the choices taken away, people are actually drawn to that because it tells them what they should do. They don't have to spend the cognitive time and effort to figure out what works best for them.
Yeah, although I don't think that's immediately apparent. I think viscerally we hear choice, that's good, I want to be able to do anything. And then when you have to actually go make the choice, that's when, you know, you wish it was smaller. Or again, we know from research, if it is smaller, you're more likely to make a decision rather than just do nothing, which gets back to that status quo default bias we were talking about earlier.
What difference does it make knowing what your neighbor is doing? How much do we compare what we're up to what's going on next door?
Sure. Well, when we ask people about their intuitions, about what messages might convince other people to, I'm going to refer to a specific experiment where they were asking people in California one hot summer to switch from the air conditioner to the fan. And they gave three messages. And one was about the financial savings. One was about being a good citizen. And one was about, you know, doing good things for the earth. And when we asked people, what did you think would be compelling? What they said was, well, for me, it's really about being a good citizen in my community. But maybe other people, this financial aspect will motivate them. Then when we actually, the door hangers, when they actually put those door hangers on different people's apartments and so forth, none of those worked. And there's a fourth one I didn't tell you about, which is telling people what your neighbors are doing.
Right.
And I think the trick there is that our intuition about what works isn't what actually happens. And so as we think about how can we approach these issues, we really do need to test those intuitions. Because like I said, what we expect is not always what happens.
And I think that that's actually one of the major challenges with this is that, you know, we look to see what other people are doing. We use that as social proof to say this is what we should do. And it's worked well to get people to lower energy if that's what your neighbors are doing. But overall, this is, you know, in these environmental things and these small things that we're asking people to do, it's a social coordination problem, right? So if basically it's, you know, I can say, yeah, I mean, we should all ride to, you know, we should all ride the bus to work instead of driving. But like, if I just do it, it doesn't make a difference.
Right.
So it's you know, over and over we come back, and I think one of the callers, Allison, I think mentioned like, oh, if everyone did this, everyone just needs to do this. But what happens is that when we say everyone needs to do it, it kind of reduces this idea that like I, as an individual, can make a difference, and that my choice to do this has an impact. And so that's one of the real challenges about these things is because, yeah, one person changing their light bulbs doesn't make a difference. It's everyone.
So how do you craft a message that gets at that makes it less, you know, passive voice and more active voice, more particular?
So some of the things that we've talked about doing, I don't know that we've actually been able to convince a community large enough to do it yet, but is basically kind of a community pact, right? So this sort of communal gathering where everyone together makes the commitment together to say this is what we're going to do. And ideally, it would be a great ceremony, lots of publicity, and everybody gets their picture hung up in City Hall if they do it, right? You can kind of build in all these other rewards for it. But you essentially want this public commitment where everyone in front of everyone else says, I'm going to do this. I'm putting my part in. And when you see everyone doing that, it provides the social proof needed to keep it powering, and it provides that coordination piece.
Yeah. One thing that's tricky is with so many of these problems, a lot of people are not doing something. And again, we talk about social proof. That sends the message that it's the norm not to bother with any of these things. So why should I?
Does that apply, though, in a place like the West where people really pride themselves on being independent? Because in some respects, it seems like I see and hear messages that, well, if everyone's doing that and they think they're cool, well, I'm going to do something different because I'm cooler, or I'm not going to go along with the group, you know, the elite group in this case.
Sure. I'm going to toss that to Meryl because she's from Idaho.
Perfect.
Yeah. Thanks. Goodness. Well, I think we have these intuitions that everybody wants to be different and unique. And yet research shows the world over that that's just not as true as we would like it to be. Because I think even in this concept of being unique, you're still identifying with this group, right? You can create these in-groups, out-groups. Which is actually really important when thinking about providing social proof, is that if you show that the people who are not like you are doing this behavior, you're actually less likely to do it. Whereas if you show that people who are like you are doing this behavior,
like your neighbors,
right? Like your neighbors, you know,
people from your school, yeah,
right. So you know, and if for example you're, you know, if you're somebody who normally shops at Whole Foods and you know, only wears organic cotton and things like that, and you go to, you know, perhaps a political rally on the other side, and you start trying to tell people or show people how great you are for the environment, yeah, you're going to get this negative reaction. So it's really about kind of identifying who's the, you know, you need in-group spokesmen who are showing what they're doing.
Yeah. This is the group identity thing. So what you're saying is that people need to speak within their – they have more credibility anyway within their own group trying to make these cases.
I think it's more a matter of impact than credibility.
Oh, I see.
That it's people want to do what other people who are like them are doing. And so the closer you can identify the activity you want with a person similar to the person you want to do that, the better. There was a wonderful study getting people to pay their taxes in the UK. And in some versions, they told people what everyone in the UK was doing in terms of tax payment. And another version, it was this thing with your neighbors. And again, compliance went up dramatically when you sort of narrowed the field to the person next door as opposed to everyone in the country. So I do think sort of localizing it a little bit and making the group seem a little bit smaller, because everyone needs to do this, is also very daunting. And so that's an element, too, of social norms.
One thing that I'd also like you to comment on is, you know, I hear a lot of messages around this sort of shaming or ridiculing people who don't do certain things. or taking them to task for instance, not buying a better car, that kind of thing. What's the value of appealing to someone's goodness in sharing these messages? Like, you can do better, you can be a better part of the community by doing X, as opposed to, you know, you're an idiot for not doing X.
Yeah, so the research definitely suggests that it's much better to approach with the good things that somebody's doing. And because, you know, it goes back to this cognitive dissonance theory, is that when people present you with information to show you that you're this terrible person, you can discount that information. You can also really discount the messenger, right? You can, and a classic example is sort of vegans, right? We have somebody at our lab who specifically researches how people feel about vegans. And it's a similar thing, right? So you feel like they're taking you to task. And what happens is that everybody just kind of dislikes vegans then, because it sort of gets to the guilt, it gets to the shaming, it gets to all these things. And so it doesn't actually – it's not the most effective way to get a behavior change. And what they've actually found is that by kind of actually doing some self-affirmation stuff before telling them ways that they can do better increases the receptiveness of that message. So before starting off and saying, look at all the terrible things that you're doing, yeah. Start off by first saying, look, we know that you care about the environment. Here's the things that you're doing that are so great for the environment. And then say, and here's how we could do even more.
Yeah. That said, I think there is a place for shame and guilt.
Oh, yeah. Those are super powerful. I don't want to take that away.
Just, they're different contexts. And again, context is really so important when it comes to how we think about these things. So
kids are great shamers, right?
Yes, they are.
and that
sort of
works.
Two reasons. Yeah.
It works amazing. Kids are incredibly powerful, right? They, for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
One is that we all want to be good role models for kids, and kids can, like, call us out on stuff, and then we feel bad about it because kids are a little bit more willing to say.
Yeah, less inhibited about just saying what it is, what they see. And the other thing is, you know, it's very hard for us to think about the future. We see that playing out in so many contexts, retirement, savings, things like that. And kids are actually one of those few things that really do get people to think more about the future. And so from the fact that they allow people to imagine the future, and then that they can just be very persistent, and you want your kids to view you in a good light, we think they definitely have a role in this.
And going back to that first caller, Jeff, he mentioned that, you know, his daughter has asthma. So that, you know, he has a, you know, the child helps him with accountability. And then it also has moved those sort of consequences and sort of the things that we think of coming off into the, like, that are way off in the future. It has brought it to the present for him, right? So he is reminded that it's much more salient for him every day to make that choice.
Yeah, because so many of these choices are preventative. You need to do something so something doesn't happen.
Right.
And sometimes when there are more concrete indicators of what's going on, that can actually be a good thing. I'm thinking about the clouds right now in Utah.
Yeah. They're pretty ugly clouds. Mariel Beasley is with us, and Jamie Fall, researchers at the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University, where they study how people make decisions and the irrationality at times of human behavior. Judy Faze is with us here, of course, and we'll get to a few more of your questions when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about how you get people to make personal, sometimes inconvenient changes for a greater good. It's about how we behave, the decisions we make, and how we put all these different things together to make that decision. Judy Faze is with us, reporter for KUER. Mariel Beasley and Jamie Full are with us. They're researchers at Duke University's Center for Advanced Hindsight. It's a research group that studies the irrationality of human behavior and how people make decisions. So there's an email from, or note anyway, that comes from Joel, who's writing from Midvale. He says, I think that at least with me, the problem is that we get so demoralized that we start to think there's nothing we could do to make a difference. Marilyn, Jamie, I wanted to get your opinion on that. It's something that Judy was sort of mentioning before, this idea that there's nothing we can do really in the scheme of things. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so being in the field of behavioral economics, we have names for everything. So
we're going to call that something.
So okay, we've got a name for this.
Good.
But I'm gonna make it radio appropriate. So okay. we call it the what the heck effect.
Got it.
And it's essentially when you might have a goal or and then something kind of comes up where it just seems impossible to meet the goal that day. And what happens is you kind of fall off. And so a good example is if you're on a diet and you are, you know, you're being really good about it. But then once you have that first Snickers and you kind of realize like, oh, gosh, I've broken this, you just give up. Mm. Right. And it's like all of a sudden 20 Snickers later and you're like, well, there goes the diet.
And rationally, you should just be like, I had the Snickers. That was bad. But again, we say, what the heck?
And so it gets into this idea that like all of a sudden it becomes fruitless, right? So with the
when it's not, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Easily just everyday reset. You can do little things, you can all do all these things, and we do know that small changes can make a big difference. But when it just feels overwhelming, right? It feels like there's a million things you need to do and so you just kind of give up.
Yeah. And one way we get around that are these sort of reset periods. So a lot of those, you know, programs that track calories, every day you reset. And so if you've done something that's not good, we kind of give you this opportunity to get back on the bandwagon.
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
And then even just kind of giving the really concrete steps about what people can do, it can help also kind of remind people of the small steps that they can do so it doesn't feel all overwhelming and they just give up.
Yeah, and that's incredibly important because so much of the messaging is about the problem. Mm-hmm. And people want to know what to do. And when it comes to really concrete things, sometimes they're not totally there. It's not totally evident the action that needs to be taken.
There's this this comes from Glenn, who he works in an oil field in eastern Utah, and he talks about it's difficult to make change because of the status quo. I won't go into all that he says, but he sort of concludes by saying the only thing that forces change is money, be it litigation or regulation or whatever. This sort of gets to something you've been talking about. That is, you know, what does work better, carrots or sticks, incentives or disincentives?
Yeah. So money can definitely be powerful, right?
Yeah, enough money, you can pay people to do anything, right? But
but the question is like, how much money does that take? And is that really something that we can do? And, you know, we have taxes on things and turns out that actually hasn't, you know, as gas prices rose, people kind of drove a little bit less, but not as much as you would think. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that show that money is actually maybe not quite as effective as we think it is.
Yeah. Think about, for example, what you would do for a cup of coffee versus what you do for whatever coffee costs, you know, right now. There's a lot of power in non-financial incentives when you just compare the impact that a gift versus the dollar amount for that gift, that the reactions to those are very different.
And you know, when people thought that it was the financial stuff that would change their behavior.
Yeah, it is our intuition, but it just isn't the case.
Right. It turns out it's telling people what other people are doing.
What is the story about the grocery bags in D.C.? I mean, taxed people 5 cents a bag. How does that work in all of this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
work a few ways.
So one of the things that we know about people is that we hate losses a lot more than we like gains. So we'll work really hard to avoid losing money, much harder than we would work to gain the same amount of money.
Yeah, the classic example is I lose $1, I need $2 to get back to where I was after that loss.
Yeah, so and thinking about how this plays out in policy is actually the, you know, when trying to get people to bring their own bags to the grocery store. So there's some places that have basically they kind of give you, if you bring your own bag, they give you 5 cents off your bill. Right. So that's a gain. Right. You're kind of earning 5 cents for bringing your bag. And it's just really hard to remember to bring your bag on those days. But in D.C., they actually just said, OK, what we're going to do is we're going to charge you for using a store bag. So they could. It's the same amount of money. It's still that 5 cents. And now all of a sudden, people can remember to bring a bag because when you get, you know, they ring up all your groceries and then they look at you and said, did you bring your own bag or do you need store bags? And you're like, oh, I need the store bags today. And they're like, okay, that's an additional two bags. That's an additional 10 cents onto your bill, which, you know, if it's at Whole Foods, you already have $150 of groceries anyway. But basically what happens is that you all of a sudden, that 10 cents just feels like too much. And it's so painful and it's outrageous. And so next time you are much more likely to bring a bag. And so framing that as a tax is like an added on painful in sort of payment that's separate from the rest of it, it's so much more powerful than if you would just give people a credit for bringing their own bag.
We're essentially out of time, so I want to ask you this. You've said that part of the good news, because I kind of wanted to end with some good news, is that these behaviors in some ways sometimes only need to be, you know, play out once, like a new car, a water heater, that you only have to sort of change them once to affect things. You want to say something about that?
Sure. I mean, we talk about changing behavior and changing habits, and that's all very long term. And what we like to think about are those one-time things. So a good example is when it comes to turning off the lights, you have to make that decision several times every day. If you can get lights or temperature or things like that on a timer, it just takes the decision out of it. And so sometimes instead of trying to improve a behavior, just switch it out with something else, automate it, and make it a one-time thing. Just make it easy.
Right. You're not gonna buy a new washer and dryer every day. You don't have to make that decision about which one. So we can kind of, you know, we talked about how do you leverage the right moment? And so you can get people to pre-commit to that one-time decision. So, you know, the selling of your car, which is extreme, I know. But even if you can get to people right at the moment where they're making the decision about which washer or dryer to buy, you can influence them in that moment, right? That moment, you can give them the right information at the right time that will help them make the sort of more energy-efficient decision. It's hard to do that on a daily basis, but these one-time decisions, getting people to just change their light bulbs once, getting people to buy the more energy-efficient dryer, getting people to buy a bus pass.
Yeah.
These one-time decisions can actually play out.
It's Mariel Beasley and Jamie Fole, researchers at the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University. Thanks, guys. We'll have you back. This is really, really interesting. Appreciate it.
Great. We enjoyed chatting with you. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Judy, thanks to you. Judy
Faze,
of course, of KUER News. And thanks to all of you who have contributed so far. You can continue the conversation at KUER.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.